much of what Roberta had said had confirmed things Fiona already knew. She needed to think about the things Roberta had deflected as quickly and neatly as if she'd been hitting shots back over the net in a tennis match. She knew the Idlewild records had been lost, Fiona scribbled. How? The only way is if she has looked for them. That made her think for a minute. It didn't stretch the imagination that as an adult and a lawyer, Roberta would have made an inquiry, looking for something about her old friend's disappearance. Once she was no longer a girl, she had used her powers as a lawyer to free her uncle and make his life as right as she could. She might have tried to make things right in Sonia's death as well, especially as she had been convinced Sonia was murdered. Perhaps she had gotten access to the same missing persons file Jamie had pulled from the Baron's police, the one that said nothing at all. The existence of the Idlewild files had been Roberta's only slip. She hadn't known about it, and she had been avidly interested. It had been one of the only times in the interview that Fiona had gotten a peek beyond the calm, careful facade. So the next question, Fiona wrote, was the only logical one. Does Roberta know who did it? And then, is she hiding it? She had been truly grieved when she'd heard about Sonia's body being found in the well. That hadn't been an act. But Fiona made herself go back over that moment carefully. What Roberta had shown was sadness and pain. What she hadn't shown was surprise. Fuck. Fuck. Fiona could have banged her forehead on the steering wheel. She had seen that, but it had been too fast, and she'd been too caught up in her own shit. She'd been outwitted by a 79-year-old woman, a woman who had spent 30 years as a successful lawyer, but still, never assume, Fiona, Malcolm said in her mind. From its place on the passenger seat, spilled out of her purse, her phone rang. She jumped, and for a second a wild hope sprang up in her that it was Jamie, but it wasn't. It was Anthony Eden. What did he want? To summon her to another meeting with his mother? She'd had enough of frustrating old women for today. She ignored the call and flipped the page in her notebook to a fresh one. She wrote a heading, Potential Suspects. It seemed like in 64 years no one had done even this basic piece of logic, so she would do it herself. She started with the obvious choice, the one the headmistress had been so convinced of. A boy. That meant Sonia had had some kind of illicit romance. She would have had to keep it from the school, because they would surely have expelled her if they knew. It would have had to be a local boy, since in the pre-internet, pre-Facebook days, there was no way she could have met a boy from anywhere else. It seemed unlikely, but Fiona kept it on the list, because if it was true, then Sonia's roommate and friend, Roberta, had likely known. And it was believable that she had kept her friend's secret all this time. She wrote another possibility. A stranger. The tale loosened, wove into a different pattern. This was Jeanette Harrison's theory that Sonia had been targeted. The killer on the road theory, a predator passing through, perhaps a delivery man or some other worker at the school. I didn't see the face of a single man for 3 years, Roberta had said. The truth or a lie? Why would Roberta cover it up if a gardener had killed her friend, or for that matter, a stranger on the road? She had to circle back to the fact that Roberta might be lying to her for reasons Fiona couldn't see. If Roberta was covering something, that led to one of the girls did it, perhaps Roberta herself, or Cece Frank, or Katie Winthrop. We always knew, Roberta had said. Sonia wouldn't run away without her suitcase. The girls could have protested that Sonia hadn't just disappeared in order to appear more innocent. The girls had had opportunity, access to Sonia, and Sonia's trust. There was no gun or other weapon used in the crime, just a rock or a shovel, something the girls would have had access to. It was easy to imagine an argument, an impulse, done in a rage, the body dumped to cover it up quickly, the girls agreeing to cover for one another, never to expose one another. And the motive? What kind of motive did teenage girls need? Jealousy, rejection, some imagined slight? The ultimate mean girls, and it explained why Roberta had not been surprised, why she had wanted access to Idlewild's records, so she could find any clues to the crime in the files and remove them. Why she had made it clear she had no idea where the other two girls were now, which could be a lie. It was the theory that fit in every detail, and it was the theory Fiona hated the most. She closed her eyes and tried to think clearly of why. It was too pat, for one, cliché, like a thriller movie. What's more sinister than a teenage girl, angry and duplicitous and full of hate? Everyone liked to picture a witchy coven of teenagers putting their hapless classmate to death, because it was easier and sexier than picturing Sonia being hit over the head by a local man who probably needed the 1950s version of mental health treatment, who had possibly sexually violated her first. But if it had been an accident, a true mistake, instead of a planned murder, then the girls would have been terrified. Covering it up would have been the first thing they'd do. She hated it, but she had to admit it was possible. It was possible that she'd just had coffee with Sonia's killer, or with a woman who was covering for Sonia's killer, her school friend. Maybe Fiona preferred picturing a man doing such a thing, or even a boy, instead of a girl. And that, she had to admit, circled back to Deb's murder. She had always wanted Tim Christopher to be Deb's killer. She had always wanted to believe that a man, sinister and big-handed and cruel, had put her innocent sister to death because it had fit. But no one had seen Tim do it, and no one had seen him dump the body. And for the first time in 20 years, Fiona let the words into her head like a cold draft from a cracked window. Could they have gotten it wrong? Tim had always maintained his innocence. Of course he had. Nearly every convicted murderer did. But what if the wrong man was in prison? What if Deb's killer was still free? Sonia's killer had walked free. That person was possibly dead, after living a life in which the murder of a 15-year-old girl had never been unearthed. Or that person was possibly living, elderly now. It was even possible that person had had a fruitful career as a lawyer, born 2 children, and spent her morning playing cat and mouse with Fiona in a New Hampshire coffee shop. "There is no justice," Malcolm had told her once, "but we stand for it anyway. Justice is the ideal, but justice is not the reality." If Tim Christopher was innocent, it would kill her father. Outside, the cold wind kicked up, and the flyer tucked beneath her windshield wiper flapped. Fiona stared at it, suddenly transfixed. It wasn't a flyer. It was a note. She got out of the car and snatched it, nearly ripping it in half. She ducked back into the driver's seat and slammed the door, smoothing out the note, staring at it. Simple handwriting on a piece of notebook paper, written in ballpoint pen. "Meet me behind the church at 11 o'clock," it said. And beneath that, "You're not looking hard enough." Chapter 23. Katie. Barrons, Vermont, November 1950. "They're probably circus freaks," Katie said, sitting cross-legged on her bunk and watching Sonia pack. "He's the world's fattest man, and she's the bearded lady. That's why they've lived alone so long, with no kids."
"You forget I've seen them," Sonia said,
calmly folding a skirt and placing it in her suitcase. "They aren't freaks. I met them when I first arrived in America." "And they forgot about you for 3 years," Katie pointed out. "Maybe they were just busy building the cell they're going to keep you in." She didn't know why she was saying these things, passing them off as jokes. It was cruel, unnecessary, considering the true horror of Sonia's past, but she couldn't seem to stop it.
"I don't want you to go."
Sonia was unperturbed despite the barbs Katie was throwing. She was calm and happy, a little flushed with expectation. Like the other three, she had never been away from Idlewild, even for an afternoon, since arriving here.
"You're packing everything,"
Cece pointed out, sitting on the floor, playing with the dials on her little radio, even though it was morning, just after breakfast, and they were at risk of getting caught. They only ever listened to the radio at night.
You're only going for 2 days. Why are you packing your uniform?
Because, Katie said when Sonia didn't answer. She thinks they're going to want to keep her. Shut up, Katie, Roberta said. She was leafing through Sonia's copy of Blackie's Girl's Annual, and she didn't look up as she issued the reprimand. There was no venom in it.
They might keep me, Sonia said, adding her pitifully small stack of underwear to the suitcase. Why else did they ask me to visit after so much time?
She looked up, and the glimpse of hope on her face, naked and bare before she tucked it away, made Katie feel a slice of pain. She was an idiot, she knew. Stupid and petty. She wanted Sonia to be happy, but not by leaving, not by going to live with strangers. And what if those strangers didn't want to keep Sonia after their visit was over? What would happen to the hope on Sonia's face then? Sonia had gained a little weight over the last few weeks. She had smoothed out, her eyes less sunken, her elbows less sharp and bony. She wasn't pretty. Katie knew with the perfect detachment of the beautiful that no one was pretty next to her. But her skin had a healthier flush to it, her gaze a calmer sparkle. Her uniform skirt was too short now, and it had begun to grow tight around the hips, though her bust was hopeless, and probably always would be. When we're out of here, Katie mused idly, I'll get her one of those padded brassieres. There were no movie magazines, no magazines at all, at Idlewild, but some of the teachers wore bras that made their bodies look like soft rocket ships beneath their blouses. Katie was fascinated by the idea, not because she found it attractive, but because she had an animal instinct that boys would. If her hips grow out some more, and I get her one of those, and I curl her hair, oh, being 18 was going to be fun. Then she remembered that Sonia might not leave here with the rest of them. I bet they're monsters, she said, unable to stop herself, unable to keep the words from scraping her throat as they came out.
Hush, Cece chided, looking up from her radio. Monsters don't exist.
They were all quiet for a moment, no one believing this, not even Cece. Katie looked up to see Sonia looking at her, watching her from those calm eyes. She had stopped packing.
I'll be back Sunday, she said quietly.
The hope draining from her friend's face was worse than anything, so of course Katie's perverse mood swung the other way.
It's best if they do keep you, she said. That way you can find a way to sneak me some dirty magazines.
Roberto laughed, glancing up from Blackie's Girl's Annual, and Sonia made a face.
What if they don't have any dirty magazines?
You find a way to get them, silly. Katie instructed her. You ask for an allowance.
I want chocolate, Cece said, perking up at this.
Books, Roberta added. For God's sake, get us something to read besides Lady Chatterley's Lover. We've already read the dirty parts to death. A squawk came from Cece's radio, and she twisted a button.
Careful with that thing, or we'll lose it, Katie said.
No one has heard us so far, Cece pointed out.
I like it. I want to know what shows are on at this time of morning.
Probably nothing. Katie watched Sonia put her notebook in the suitcase, accompanied by the pen, her hairbrush, her nightgown. I don't think they start the shows this early. The radio squawked again as Cece turned the dial. Sonia looked at the book in Roberta's hand.
You can borrow that if you like, she said.
Roberta looked at her. Her calm gaze cracked for a fraction of a second, a flinch that only someone who knew her well would be able to see. Katie read her thoughts perfectly, since they mirrored her own. You might not come back.
No, she said, her placid voice recovered. You take it.
She handed it over, and it went into the suitcase with the other things. If they don't want you, come back, she said to Sonia. We'll be here.
You'll be late for class, Sonia observed, closing the suitcase on its painfully few contents and latching it. Don't you have Latin?
They would be late for class. There was only half an hour of break time allotted after the first class of the day, and it was already stretching past that now. Soon someone, dorm monitor Susan Brady or Lady Loon herself, would come knocking on doors, shouting that the lazy girls needed to get their things. Still, nobody moved. "What time is your bus?" Cece asked for the dozenth time, though they all knew the answer.
12 o'clock, Sonia replied, as she had every other time. I should stop walking to the bus stop soon.
Do you have your ticket? Roberta asked. Sonia nodded. Her relatives had mailed her the ticket when she'd accepted the invitation. She had carefully placed it in the pocket of her wool coat so she wouldn't lose it, as if she had so many things that she was in danger of not keeping track of them. Now, despite her earlier excitement, even Sonia seemed reluctant. She picked up her shoes and sat on the edge of her bunk, slowly putting them on. The radio in Cece's hands stopped its static blast, and the harmony of a barbershop quartet emitted from it. A voice came over the music.
"Welcome to the Pilcrow Soap Sunrise Show."
"Sunrise was hours ago," Katie snorted.
"Shh," Roberta said.
Sonia continued slowly, pulling on her shoes. The singing continued, sweet and buttery, the notes slipping so easily from one voice to the next. "Sweet dreams of you, sweet dreams are true. Sweet dreams of us saying, yes, I do." The girls listened in silence, hypnotized, no longer caring about teachers or dorm monitors or Latin. A few sweet moments of peaceful quiet, the kind only the radio could give them. A few moments of nothing but sound from the world outside, where people were living and singing and playing songs, normal people in a normal world. Far off down a hallway, a single door slammed. The radio squawked in Cece's hand, the singing interrupted. It blasted briefly, then it was gone again. Silence came from the little box. Not static, not music, just silence.
"What did you do?" Roberta said.
"Nothing." Cece stared down at the radio. "I didn't touch anything."
Steps sounded in the hall.
"Someone's coming," Katie whispered, her lips cold and numb with sudden fear. Cece shook her head.
There was the sound of breathing, a breath in, a breath out, from the radio. Katie felt her temples pulse, her vision blur. She had heard that same breathing, sensed it, in special detention.
"She's here."
The four girls sat frozen in a tableau, no one moving, and from the radio, breaking the breathing silence, came the thin, reedy, distressing cry of a baby's wail. It wavered, as if far away, as if weak, and then it cried again. Cece dropped the radio with a thump. She kicked it hard, and it spun under the bed, hitting the wall, the baby's wail cutting off. A knock pounded on the door.
"Ladies?"
Lady Loon shouted through the wood, making them all jump.
"Ladies, you are late for class!"
There was a frozen moment in which nobody moved. And then Katie leaned over, took Sonia's icy hand in hers, and looked into her face.
"Go," she said.
Chapter 24. Portsmouth, New Hampshire, November 2014. There was more than one church in Portsmouth. There were many, and Fiona silently cursed her anonymous note writer. What the hell church did he or she mean? New England was hardly bereft of churches. She blew out a breath and checked the time on her phone. It was 10:45. Should she stay for 15 minutes and play into this person's game, or should she start her car and drive away? She already faced a wet drive back to Vermont, and she wanted to get back into the Idlewild files, which she'd barely had time to skim through. She wanted to talk to Malcolm. Even, if he'd let her, to Jamie. Still, you're not looking hard enough. God damn it. It was as if whoever it was knew how to reach into her journalist's psyche and flip the switch of her curiosity, the switch that couldn't be turned off, the switch that would most likely get her killed one of these days. But it was morning in sunny New Hampshire,
with the thin, wet snow melting and retirees walking by to go into the twee coffee shops beneath pretty awnings. She hadn't even processed the thought fully before she got out of the car and slammed the door behind her. Inhaling a bite of the chill air, she stepped to the hood of the car, where the note lever would have stood to tuck the paper beneath her windshield wiper, and did a slow 360-degree turn, scanning the horizon. When you looked at it that way, it was unmissable. There was a church only several hundred feet away, one of New England's historical specialties, red brick with a tall, elaborate white steeple, as pretty as a wedding cake. The clock embedded halfway up the steeple showed the time. Fiona left the parking lot and made her way toward it, crossing the cobblestone walks. She got close enough to the front to read the sign and see that it was called the North Church and that it dated from 1671, the building itself from 1855. The front doors were open, a cloth welcome sign propped up outside them. Fiona circled around toward the back. She didn't see anyone, just more tourists and retirees, and a panhandler sitting on the ground, leaning against the church wall, his knees drawn up. That struck her as odd, since panhandlers were rare in tourist areas like this one. Most of them moved along by private security or the cops. She looked at the panhandler again and realized he was watching her. He was a man, thin and stringy as a kid, in his 30s, his long hair combed back from his forehead. On second look, Fiona realized he wasn't panhandling at all. He had no sign or overturned hat. He was just sitting against the wall, looking at her. His face was pale and pitted, his eyes sunken, his clothes of good quality but well-worn. He wasn't homeless, but a man down on his luck. Sick, perhaps, used to sitting on the cold ground and watching crowds go by. She walked up to him and held out the note. "Are you looking for me?" His eyes didn't leave her face as he looked up from his low position on the ground. He watched her for a long time. She saw uncertainty in his gaze and calculation and anger mixed with fear. "Be careful with this one," she told herself. Finally, he smiled and stood up, bracing himself against the church wall. "Hi, Fiona," he said. She stepped back, glad now that they were in an open square in daylight with people around. This had been a mistake. "Do I know you?" "I'm sorry about the note," he said, watching her reaction. "I didn't know how else to approach you. It seemed the best way." "Okay, well, I'm here now. How do you know me, and what do you want?" The man shifted his weight. Now that they were face to face, he made no move to come closer. "My name is Stephen," he said. "Stephen Heyer." She shook her head. He wasn't sick, she realized now. He was healthy, his eyes sharp and unclouded. The gray of his skin and his matchstick thinness spoke of addiction instead. He looked away, past her shoulder, as if considering what to say. He hadn't really planned this, she thought. He'd likely thought she wouldn't follow the note. He scratched the back of his neck with a restless hand. "I followed you here from Barron's." Fiona's blood went cold. "You met with that woman," Stephen Heyer continued. "I thought maybe, but I don't recognize her. I don't know who she is." He looked back at her face, and she saw something naked in his eyes, a desperation that looked painfully familiar. "Does she have something to do with Tim Christopher?" Fiona took another step back as if she'd been slapped. "Fuck off," she said to him, with all the icy cold she could summon into her voice, denying her fear, her sudden shakiness. She turned and walked away. She could hear him behind her, trailing her. "Wait," he said. "You've been going to Idlewild, to the Restoration. I've seen you there." What the hell was this? Some stupid game? She kept walking. "Leave me alone or I'll call the police." "I go to Old Barron's Road. Sleep there sometimes," he said, still following her, as if he was compelled to explain. "The old man who used to run the drive-in lets me use his place." "You go there to get high?" she shot back over her shoulder. "No, no," he protested. "I have some problems, yeah, but that's not why. That's not what I'm getting at." Her mind was racing. If he was a Baron's local, he must have known about Deb. He was around her own age, the right age to have been a teenager when it happened. She racked her brain again for the name Stephen Heyer, trying to put it in context, but she was sure she'd never heard it before, that he hadn't gone to her high school. She pegged him as some kind of creep, a ghoul, maybe looking to scare her for money. She did not need this shit. She really did not. "I've seen you," he said. He was following at her shoulder. He gave off a curiously diminished vibe, as if he was so low on life force that he couldn't be dangerous. Fiona knew by instinct that she didn't have to run or scream. If she got in her car and drove away, he'd simply recede, defeated. So she strode purposefully toward the parking lot. "That red hair," he continued. "It's unmistakable. I've seen you, Deb Sheridan's sister, the journalist, coming back to Idlewild. Looking, right? They're restoring it, and you can't stay away. I figure you must be looking. You think I don't understand, but I do." Fiona turned and stared at him. He wasn't lying. He was telling the truth, at least as he knew it. "Listen," she said to him. "Whatever you think you know, I do not give a shit. Do you understand? Stop following me, or I'll call the cops. Whatever crazy shit is in your brain right now, I suggest you forget about it. Forget about me. I am none of your business." "You want answers," Stephen said. He didn't seem high, but she wondered how long it had been since his last fix. Closure, right? That's what they call it. The therapists and group sessions and grief counselors. They don't talk about what a load of bullshit that is. He stared at her, and she saw frustration behind his eyes, some kind of crazy pain that spiraled through him, undulled by drugs. He gestured down at himself. "You think I got this way because I got closure?" Her mouth was dry. "Closure for what?" "You're not looking hard enough," Stephen said, echoing his own note. "I've been looking for closure for 20 years, just like you. But I looked harder, and I found you." She shook her head. "I don't know what the hell that means." "I know how it feels." He was strangely eloquent now, his eyes bright, an evangelist speaking the truth he knew best. "You're all in here," he tapped his temple, "and you can't get out. It goes round and round. You're thinking, always fucking thinking. The therapists and the grief counselors, they don't understand. They want you to talk and write things down and share, but nothing makes it go away. I did drugs, you go walking at Idlewild." It was as if he were hitting her with the words, punching her in the stomach. "Did you know my sister?" she rasped. "No," Stephen Heyer said. "But I want Tim Christopher dead." "What?" She tried to get a grip, sound rational. "Are you some kind of death penalty advocate?" Vermont didn't have the death penalty. "I don't give a shit about the death penalty," Stephen said, his eyes alight. "I just want him dead. Not for what he did to your sister. For what he did to mine." There are moments when everything shifts. When the world becomes eerily like the kaleidoscope toy given to children, where with the turn of a cheap plastic knob, everything changes, becomes different. Fiona looked at the man in front of her, and the calm of downtown Portsmouth disappeared. The colors changed. The air smelled different. Everything flew upward, scattered, and landed again. Her head throbbed. "Who was your sister?" she asked him. "What did Tim do?"
"Who is my sister?" he corrected her, his voice bitter. "Helen Elizabeth Heyer, born July 9, 1973. Would you like to meet her?"
Her voice was a rasp, but she didn't hesitate, the words slipping out of her as they always did when she was buzzed like this, restless, the madness in her blood. "Yes," she told Stephen, "I would."
"My car is parked over there," he said, pointing down the street.
He smiled when he saw her expression.
"How the hell do you think I followed you to New Hampshire? I'm a fucking addict, not a bum. It's a blue Chevy. I'll pull out and wait for you."
"Where are we going?" Fiona asked him, her temples pounding.
"Back to Vermont," he said. "I'll lead the way. You follow."
Chapter 25.
Barrons, Vermont, November 2014. The Barrons Police Department was emptying out at 5 o'clock, the day staff packing up and going home. They kept a dispatcher on at night, but in a town as small as Barrons, that was all that was needed. A few cops were kept on call in case of emergencies, and a duty officer stayed on until midnight in case of evening domestic disputes, noise complaints, or bar customers that got out of hand. The parking lot was nearly empty when Fiona pulled in, though Jamie's SUV was still there. Holding a file folder in her hand, Fiona walked through the front door and saw the dispatcher sitting behind the front desk. He looked to be nearly 70, and he was peacefully leafing through a fishing magazine. He looked up with some surprise.
"Help you?"
he said. He knew who she was. Of course he did. If he didn't know she was Malcolm Sheridan's daughter, dating a fellow cop, she'd eat her journalism diploma. But she said, "I'm looking for Jamie Creel. Is he around?"
"Are you here to report a crime?"
he asked. "I'm here to see Jamie." The dispatcher slid a clipboard across the desk at her.
"You'll need to sign in. Name, address, identification."
It was bullshit. This was Barrons, not Rikers Island. "Just tell me where to find him." His hairy white eyebrows rose on his forehead.
"I'll have to get my supervisor's approval to let a journalist in here."
"If you know I'm a journalist, then you know my name." She slid the clipboard back across the desk at him. "Go ahead and write it down." She walked past before he could protest. She'd never been inside here, even when Deb died. The cops had interviewed her at the house, sitting in the living room, her parents beside her. "I last saw my sister on Sunday, when she visited for dinner. No, I haven't talked to her since. No, I don't know where she could have gone." And then, after the body was found, "No, she never mentioned anyone following her or threatening her. Yes, I've met Tim Christopher. No, I didn't talk to her that night." They had been exhausted, those cops that interviewed her. Bewildered, maybe in over their heads. Neither of them had been Garrett Creel. Jamie was at his desk, a tiny cubicle in the open main room of the station, in front of a 2000-era desktop computer. He was in uniform, though his hat was off, and the top buttons of his uniform shirt were undone, the white T-shirt he wore beneath it contrasting with the navy blue. He had obviously heard Fiona's voice because he was already watching her when she came around the corner from the front dispatch desk, and his eyes, flat and wary, watched her come toward him.
"There a problem?"
he said. "Can we talk somewhere?" she asked him. His gaze stayed on her face for a minute, and she knew he was reading her, the fact that she wasn't here for personal reasons. What did he expect? That she'd bring whatever they had to his work while he was on shift to try to hash things out? He knew her better than that. His eyes darted briefly to the back of the dispatch desk, and then to the others in the room, a cop putting his coat on, another standing by the coffee machine, and pushed back his chair.
"Come with me."
He led her to an interview room, a closet-sized space with two chairs and a table between them. There was no two-way glass, like on TV cop shows. Fiona wondered if Tim Christopher had ever been in this room, if he had ever sat in one of these chairs.
"What's going on?"
Jamie asked, clicking the door shut behind them. Fiona looked at him. Jamie, tall, broad shoulders, dark blonde hair worn slightly long and brushed back from his forehead, scruff of gold on his jaw. She'd missed him, but when Jamie wore his uniform, he was less familiar to her, less like the man who had first said hi to her in a bar on a Friday night. The uniform did that, made him a different man. "Do you know the name Helen Heyer?" she asked him.
"No,"
he said. "Think," she said. "Assault case, unsolved. She nearly died." Jamie put his hands on his hips, forefingers hooked over his hip bones, the classic pose of the cop pulling you over, and narrowed his eyes, thinking.
"No, I don't think so. When was this?"
"She was assaulted in 1993, Fiona said. "She was 20. She's 41 now."
"I was 8 in 1993, Jamie said.
But it doesn't sound familiar, Fiona persisted. She was found just outside the back door of her parents' home. She'd probably been on the back walkway, coming to the door when it happened. Someone used a weapon on her, likely a baseball bat. Nothing stolen. She was nearly dead when her father opened the back door to take the garbage out, but her blood was warm. It was quick and silent. Jamie was staring at her. Behind his eyes, she could see him thinking, calculating, going over the angles. He was telling the truth. He probably didn't know the case she was talking about. But he knew she wasn't here for a random reason. He knew she was going somewhere, and he was trying to figure out where it was. There was no baffled confusion in his face, just a closed-off determination to figure out what angle she was going to come from, so he could put up a defense before she got there.
"Did she live?"
he asked her.
"You didn't say murder."
"She lived," Fiona said, swallowing down the lump in her throat. "She's in a long-term care hospital in Beaufield. Her cognitive functions were damaged, and she can't care for herself. She can barely form words, can barely do the most basic functions of life. She hasn't spoken a complete sentence since the assault." She held up the file folder she'd been carrying in her hand. "I went to see her this afternoon. No one was ever arrested, Jamie. No one saw the attack, and Helen can't name her attacker. She was supposed to be dead." Jamie shook his head.
"What does this have to do with me, Fee?"
She slapped the file down on the table, harder than she'd intended. "Keep it under control, Fiona. Keep to the facts." "It's interesting," she said, opening the folder and pulling out the printouts of newspaper articles that she'd made at home in her apartment before coming here. "It was a big story at the time. The police went to the local media to ask for help. Anyone who had seen the crime, anyone who had seen a stranger in the neighborhood, was asked to call in a tip. It was tragic. A pretty 20-year-old girl beaten nearly to death, her life destroyed on her parents' doorstep, left for her daddy to find when he took out the garbage. Beaten while her parents were inside, eating supper and watching Jeopardy!" She spread the articles out. "But not one of these pieces reported what her brother told me this afternoon. Helen had a boyfriend. A new boyfriend. He was big, handsome, rich, and she was excited. His name was Tim Christopher." Jamie had been looking down at the printouts, the school photo of Helen Heyer on the top page, her lovely oval face framed by dark hair that she had placed smoothly over one shoulder for the photograph, smiling for the camera. But when she said Tim's name, he looked up sharply.
"What?"
"Her parents didn't know," Fiona said. "The relationship was physical, and her parents would have been horrified that their daughter had given up her virginity. But her brother found out about it. She swore him to secrecy, begged him not to tell their parents about Tim. She was swept up by him. She thought Tim was wonderful, most of the time. According to her brother, there were occasions she was quiet and withdrawn because she and Tim had had a fight. But then she'd forgive him, and all would be well again. Except for the part about not telling her parents, it was Deb, her exact pattern with Tim, except further back in time. Deb had been so excited to be dating Tim. She was 20 and thought that the world held bigger and better things for her than life in barrens with her nerdy parents and their middle-class income. She'd seen wide horizons with Tim, probably because he'd promised them to her. And Helen was Deb, a year before Deb met Tim and died." She watched the knowledge flicker across Jamie's face. She read him closely. He hadn't known about Helen, yet he didn't register surprise or even shock. What settled into the corners of his eyes was a heavy kind of knowledge, as if he was hearing something he hadn't known but could have guessed would happen. Still, his voice was tense, defensive.
"Did they think Tim was a suspect?"
"When Helen's brother told the cops about Tim, they questioned Tim, at his parents' home, not at the station. One conversation, and then they dropped it."
"Then he must have had an alibi."
"He said he was at the movies at the time, alone. Nothing to back it up. He also claimed that he had never met Helen Heyer, had no idea who she was, and certainly was not dating her.
Maybe he was telling the truth.
She stared at him in shock. You realize you're talking about the man serving life in prison right now.
Just because he committed that crime doesn't mean he committed this one.
Jamie sighed.
Fiona, I told you, I know nothing about this case. But if there was no arrest, it's because the officers in charge of the investigation didn't find enough evidence to arrest a suspect. It's their job to close cases. Their job to chase these things down. You're looking for something that isn't there.
Isn't there? She nearly shouted. If the police had done their job, even a little, Tim would have been arrested before Deb even met him. She would be alive.
Assuming Tim did this, Jamie countered, indicating the articles strewn on the table. This girl was hit with a baseball bat, not strangled. She was left at her parents' house, not dumped in a field. Deb was seen with Tim dozens of times, while this girl was not. What evidence do you have that he was dating her at all?
She admitted to her brother that she was.
Did the brother ever see him? Jamie asked. Did Tim come to the house, meet the parents? Did he talk to them on the phone? The cops would have asked her friends and family if they'd ever seen her with him. Did they do that?
Fiona was quiet.
Of course they did, Jamie said. So she never told her parents about this great boyfriend she was supposedly seeing, and she never told her friends. Just one person knew, her brother. And he was reliable?
He was into drugs, Fiona said. It got worse after his sister's attack. He became an addict. But he wasn't an addict when it happened. Just a teenager messing around.
For God's sake, Fiona, Jamie said. You're listening to a story spun by a drug addict? Because that's who you've been talking to, isn't it? The brother.
Damn it. She had known this would happen, that he would be like this, and it made her so angry. He's telling the truth, she said, fighting the impulse to shout. He knows what his sister told him. There's nothing wrong with his memory.
And how did he find you?
Jamie's gaze was hard and cold.
Because he did find you, didn't he? He found some way to approach you and reel you in. You're a smart woman, Fee. But when it comes to anyone mentioning your sister's name, you can be completely goddamn stupid.
She stared at this Jamie, and she didn't know him. Fuck you, she spit at him. That's the cruelest thing you've ever said to me.
I'm cruel,
he said.
Did you plan to go to your father with this? Was that your idea? To rip his wounds open with an unproven theory that his daughter's death could have been prevented? Your evidence is hearsay from a girl who hasn't spoken in 20 years and an addict. You'll kill him with this kind of shit.
He took a breath.
But it's all an acceptable sacrifice, isn't it? Your life, your father's life, your own happiness, our relationship. It's all an acceptable sacrifice to you. This case has already taken your parents' marriage and your mother's life. What's a little more misery for the pile?
The words made her wince. Yet she felt that only now, after a year together, were they getting to the heart of it. You think I should drop it, she said.
Of course I think you should drop it. Do you know why? Because you should fucking drop it.
Really? Or does this have to do with your precious police force? She shoved the words at him. The cops did a shit job on this case, Jamie. You know as well as I do that it's always the boyfriend. It's always the boyfriend. You think someone came up randomly behind her with a baseball bat? Did anyone think that even for a minute? But we're talking about Tim Christopher, aren't we? Rich, good-looking, his family one of the wealthiest in the county. Oh, no, sir, no way it could be the boyfriend. Sorry to bother you. We'll just be on our way. God damn it, Fee! Jamie shouted. His face was red. You want to talk about acceptable sacrifice? Fiona said to him. What's an acceptable sacrifice to you? Is it acceptable that Helen's case is never solved, that her attacker goes free, just so that the Christophers aren't bothered with too many questions? Is it an acceptable sacrifice that you brush me off just so no one asks questions now, so that the Force doesn't face any criticism? Everything is smoother, easier if we just let it go. He was breathing hard, trying to keep control.
You need to leave,
he said, his voice low and furious.
Now.
You're right, Fiona said. I do. She picked up her papers, put them in the folder, and walked out the door. Chapter 26 Barrons, Vermont, November 2014. Fiona was hungry by the time she got home to her apartment. She pulled a box of crackers from the cupboard and stood at the kitchen counter, dipping the crackers in a jar of peanut butter and eating them as she stared at the file that contained Helen Heyer's press and refused to think about Jamie. It was hard to look at the photo of 20-year-old Helen with her clear eyes and silky dark hair and compare it with the face she'd seen this afternoon. Helen at 41 was vacant, confused, her eyes sunken and the corners of her mouth turned down, her hair graying. She looked at least 50. She'd sat in the chair in the corner of her hospital room and watched her brother anxiously, rubbing the knuckles of her left hand with her right fingers in a gesture meant to soothe herself. Jamie was right that almost nothing about the two crimes matched, but Fiona knew it in her gut. They didn't match because Tim Christopher had a temper. The crimes hadn't been planned. He'd simply done what was easiest in his white-hot rage when a girl made him angry. Strangled her in his back seat, hit her with a baseball bat, whatever made her shut up for good. He was so careless he'd rubbed Deb's blood on the thigh of his jeans as an afterthought. The ice in Jamie's voice. What's a little more misery for the pile? Screw it. Fiona opened the cupboard under the sink and pulled out the bottle of wine she kept there for emergency purposes. It had been there since last Christmas, because very few things counted as big enough emergencies for Fiona to drink Chardonnay, but screw it. Her sister was dead, her love life was a mess, she had no career to speak of, and she was scooping crackers in peanut butter alone in her apartment. It was time for a glass. She had just taken a sip, making that involuntary shudder that always accompanied the first swallow, when her cell phone rang. It was Anthony Eden again. She sighed and answered it. Fiona Sheridan.
Fiona, Anthony said. I've been getting calls from the press about the body found at Idlewild. What do I say to them?
Calls? From who? He listed two names Fiona didn't recognize, probably second stringers or freelancers.
Word has gotten out, he said. What do I say?
Fiona picked up a cracker and jabbed at the jar of peanut butter. She wasn't hungry anymore. Tell them you have no statement yet, she advised him. You're waiting for the police to notify next of kin. That's how it works. The next of kin hears it before the media does. Sonia Gallipo had no next of kin, but the ruse would work for a while.
All right, he said, sounding relieved. And one more thing.
What is it?
I hear you somehow found the Idlewild records.
That surprised her. How the hell do you know that?
It doesn't matter, Anthony said. The records weren't on the grounds when Mother and I bought the property. I thought they were lost. I'd like to have them back.
Margaret, Roberta, and now Anthony. It seemed a lot of people were looking for the records, but she was not in the mood to be nice. You can't have them, she told him. I need them for research.
But they're part of the Idlewild property.
When they were sent to the dump in 1979, they ceased being Idlewild property, she said. They became garbage, which makes them mine.
Fiona, I would really like those records.
Then get a court order, Fiona said, and hung up. She sipped her wine again. He hadn't answered the question of how he knew she had the records. Roberta knew, but Anthony didn't know her. He could have been in touch with Sarah London or Kathy. Or his mother could have been making an educated guess. She looked at the boxes, stacked in her living room. They seemed to stare back at her. She picked up her wine and began the search. She started with the girls' files. Sonia's and Roberta's she'd already read, so she pulled Katie Winthrop's and Cece Frank's. Sarah London had said that Katie Winthrop was trouble. Her file backed that up. She'd been sent to Idlewild by her parents for persistent, willful misbehavior, and the school had not improved her much. There were fistfights, cut classes, talking back to teachers, everything a restless teenage girl might do in the days before she could text her friends or put naked selfies on social media. For a cloistered girl with no access to drugs, alcohol, or boys, Katie's exploits seemed painfully innocent. Hung her undergarments from a window, read an entry from her last week at Idlewild. But the school's teachers saw her as a plague that could infect the other students. Isolation is best wherever possible, one teacher wrote, as she tends to have an effect on others. Katie left the same year Roberta did, 1953, and there was no note regarding her leaving, as the teachers were likely too busy sighing with relief. Cece Frank's file was surprising. Sarah had said that she had followed Katie around, the sort of girl who fell under Katie's spell. Fiona had pictured an eager follower, an acolyte type of girl. Yet Cece's actual file showed something entirely different. Her grades were on the high side of average, though Sarah London had referred to her as stupid. She was never disciplined, never got in fights, and never acted out. Sarah had called her pudgy, but she had scored good marks even in physical education, where her teacher praised her dexterity. Could be an asset to the field hockey team, went the note, but does not seem motivated to apply herself. It now looked like Cece was the kind of girl who was kind, friendly, and far from stupid, yet never earned an ounce of praise from the adults in her life, and there could be only one reason. Her bastard heritage must have colored everyone's perceptions in 1950. It still colored Sarah London's perceptions now. When Fiona saw nothing in her file referring to who her father was or why she'd been sent to Idlewild, she knew she was right. She poured herself another glass of wine and took a break from the files to Google the girls. Katie Winthrop was a dead end. 20 minutes of searching brought up nothing that remotely resembled someone who could have been the Idlewild girl. Cece Frank's name appeared on a list of girls belonging to a college sorority in 1954, but nowhere else. So Cece had at least gone to college then. Fiona wondered if her father had paid for that, too. She returned to the boxes and leafed through the student files, looking for names that jumped out at her, but nothing did. She moved on from the student records to the other boxes, curricula, financial records, mixed detritus taken from the classrooms. She picked up the Latin textbook she'd noticed earlier, the ridiculous Latin grammar for girls, and leafed through it, smelling its musty old book smell and looking at the thick yellowed pages, the fonts that weren't in use anymore. She noticed the handwriting halfway through the book. A line written in pencil along the edge of the page, past the margin of text. She turned the book to read the words. Mary Hand wears a black dress and veil. She laughed like my dead little brother. Madeline Grazer, February 2, 1935. A black dress and veil. The words froze the breath in her throat, and she had to close the book and put it down for a second. February 1935. Someone had seen the figure she saw in the sports field in 1935. What did she show you? That is the question you need to be asking. She picked up the book again, turned the pages, and saw more words in a different handwriting scrawled across the bottom of another page. Mary Hand has always been here. Jesus. Roberta had mentioned that the girls wrote in the textbooks. If the textbooks were never changed from year to year, it made sense. This was how the Idlewild girls talked to one another, from one generation of girls to the next. She pushed the box of textbooks aside and dug through the box of Idlewild's own records, bills of sale, staff hiring and firing paperwork, financial sheets. She found what she was looking for almost immediately in a file called Land History, slim with very few pages in it. She found schematics and building plans, a map of the grounds that was dated 1940. Behind that was a handwritten map, originally done in ink and now very faded. It showed Old Barron's Road, the woods, the ravine. Within the clearing, where Idlewild now stood, were drawn a square marked church and another marked hand house. The caption at the bottom, also handwritten, said, Map of Original Landholdings, 1915. Church burned down in 1835 and never rebuilt, though the foundation was still intact. It was signed Lila Hendrickson, 1921. So this was, or purported to be, what had stood on the site before Idlewild was built. Fiona did a quick check in the staff records. Lila Hendrickson was listed as the school's history teacher from 1919 to 1924. Fiona tapped her wine glass with a fingernail, thinking. It was easy to imagine Idlewild's history teacher, most likely a local woman, also being an amateur historian. In any case, she'd written her own notes on the history of the place and kept them in Idlewild's files. Fiona's gaze traveled back to the second square on the map, Hand House. There had been an actual Hand family, and they'd lived here before the school came. She turned the page and found another sheet, this one also in Lila Hendrickson's immaculate, slanted handwriting. The page told, briefly and succinctly, the story and the tragedy of the Hand family. The Hands lived on the land for several generations, eking out a living as small farmers. By 1914, the family line had dwindled to two parents and a daughter, Mary. At age 16, Mary got pregnant by a local boy. Ashamed, she kept the pregnancy a secret until she gave birth one night at home. Her stunned mother assisted with the birth while her father looked on. The baby was born dead, though Mary was convinced that her parents had killed it. Fiona wondered if she was right. In any case, when her parents took the baby away, Mary quickly became unhinged, and there was an argument. It ended with Mary's father banishing her from the house in the cold, where Mary disappeared into the night. Her body was found the next morning, curled up in the ruins of the old church. She wasn't buried in the Hand graveyard plot, but instead on the grounds of the homestead, with her baby's body beside hers. Her parents had moved away soon afterward. The land was then purchased for the use of the school, the Hands forgotten. Mary's grave, Lila Hendrickson wrote, was situated on the south side of the burned church. Fiona turned back to the map. She oriented the page, recalling in her head which way was north. She found the spot that was south of the square that indicated the church. Then she pulled out the map of the grounds that was created in 1940 and laid it next to Lila Hendrickson's handwritten one. The burned church had sat roughly where Idlewild's dining hall was now, and Mary and her baby's grave was where the garden currently sat, the garden that was always in shade. Her baby was buried in the garden, Roberta had said. The rumor was mostly true. What was missing was that Mary Hand was buried there, too, right next to the common, where the girls had passed by every day for the 60 years the school had been open. Fiona jumped when her phone rang. She answered it eagerly when she saw who it was. "Dad," she said.
"Well," Malcolm asked her, "what do you say? Has history come alive?"
She stared down at the maps in front of her, at Lila Hendrickson's record.
"What?" "Jeanette Harrison," he said. "The Ravensbrook historian."
Fiona sat back, her rear and lower back aching from sitting on the floor for so long. "Oh, yes." She'd never updated him about that. Hearing his voice now made her think of her day with Stephen Heyer and what she'd learned about Tim Christopher.
"Did you plan to go to your father with this?" Jamie had asked. "You'll kill him with this shit." "How did it go?" Malcolm asked. "I have great respect for Jeanette. I've known her for years."
"Right," she said, gathering her thoughts. She told him what she and Jeanette had talked about, going over everything she'd learned about Ravensbrook. "That poor girl," her father said softly. "We'll never know her life story now. No one will ever know. So much has been lost. It's such a shame." "It feels otherworldly," Fiona admitted. "The concentration camp stories. Like it happened in a far-off era or on another planet."
"It does," Malcolm agreed.